tuned into Tidings, and this is Hazel Khan with my guest, Dr. Sarah Bhattacharjee. Our conversation, first broadcast on WPKN in 2009, took place as we sat together in Vellore, Tamil Nadu, in South India. When I interviewed Dr. Sarah Bhattacharjee earlier this year, the great American healthcare battles had not begun in earnest, and healthcare as a human right was still an unfamiliar notion. Since then, I've tried to understand what it is that expectations of healthcare tell us about the obligations of a government to its citizens. Why, I asked, does our government not take for granted that its citizens are entitled to healthcare? Why is there so much argument about this fundamental question? Why is there any argument at all? I concluded that its people are seen as expense items on this country's balance sheet. Quite simply, people cost too much. I've just returned from Berlin, where I learned that along with education and an unconditional right to a basic living income, the right, that is, to live as a social being, healthcare is considered a mandatory necessity and premiums are determined by income. What is the basis for such policies? I asked some German friends. Perhaps, one proposed, it originates in the feudal lords who considered it a matter of pride to look after their serfs and staff in a decent manner. More definitively, though, we have to hand it to Otto von Bismarck. In 1883, in the first of many acts of social legislation, he was able to pass the Health Insurance Bill, followed by Accident Insurance and Old Age and Disability Bills. That's why we don't have homelessness or people living in cars in Germany, I was told by Denise Wade, who lives in Munich and who has experienced both German and US healthcare. Everyone's considered a valuable human being, she continued, reminding me that there's no death penalty in the European Union. These programs, she told me, in her words, help create and maintain stability. The social tapestry is stronger and lasts longer. It's the difference between capitalism and social democracy, she concluded, pointing out that Marx and Lenin were alive when Bismarck was chancellor. We didn't discuss other ways in which Germany has demonstrated the value it places on human life, but please do rest assured that I don't need to be reminded of post-Bismarck Germany, of the Third Reich, and whatever its healthcare policies were. Still puzzled by the moral vacuum at the heart of the American healthcare debate, I return to the Tidings program broadcast in May of this year. Please listen. While visiting South India in March, I was very fortunate to meet Dr. Sarah Bhattacharjee, a physician trained in community medicine and director of a healthcare program in Vellore in the state of Tamil Nadu. Started 25 years ago, this low-cost effective care unit is today a 40-bed general practice unit, part of Christian Medical College, that caters to the poorer people of Vellore's slums with outreach to two neighboring rural blocks. We all know what a hospital is, but I had only a dim understanding of what community is until I visited the urban and rural centers and saw Dr. Sarah's vision in action.
Because we work with very poor people, it is obvious they are not able to pay for the services that we provide. Although we use many ways to keep the costs down, healthcare is still a very expensive proposition for most people. The people who come to us are people who work for daily wages. They carry loads in the marketplace or they work on construction sites.
This is the men and the women?
Yes, men and women. Some of the women are domestic workers. Some of them work at home. The BD rolling, BD is the local cigarette. BD rolling industry is very strong in and around Vellore, so many people are involved in the BD industry. But it doesn't pay that well to the ordinary worker. So we find a lot of variety of illnesses that come to us, from children up to old age. We look after everybody. And when I first started working in this unit, I was quite horrified to find that there were so many people with diabetes and hypertension and obesity.
Why were you surprised?
Because I thought that poor people won't get these illnesses, you see. I thought I was expecting to see a lot of infectious illness, and it's there. But there's also a lot of the chronic lifestyle diseases. And I realized, got to know the patients and talked to them, I realized that they eat a lot of rice because they get it cheaply on the from the fair price shops, and very little anything else, because they really can't afford to get vegetables or even pulses and grams.
So they've always had these diseases,
so
not just since you just...
Probably they've had it for... Well, maybe, the crowding and the moving into the town areas is worse now. But of course, I don't know, because I've seen them from when I came in. And I really don't know whether this is a new epidemic or whether this is something... Because now it's happening all over the country. Mm. So
yes, one expects malnutrition, not obesity.
Yeah, one expects it to be undernutrition rather than overnutrition. Mm-hmm. But it's also because the work they do, although they work very hard, it's all sitting down work. Mm. In the rural areas, they're out in the fields, so they're actually expending their energy. Mm. But much of the work is either rolling BDs or rolling incense sticks or making pickles or cooking. These are things that they do sitting down. In the outpatient, we service anybody who comes to us from the town. But we have a focus on the slum population. And we intensively work in 8 or 9 slums in and around us, using volunteers to work for us. We started with a problem with working with people with disability. We asked for volunteers, and wherever they provided us a volunteer, then we worked in that area. So we trained 9 volunteers, of which one had to drop out for personal reason. The other 8 completed the training and continued to work after the training period was finished. Now 2 or 3 of them have got other jobs, but they still keep in touch with us and they still work together. They inform each other if there is something that they're doing together.
These volunteers, what Dr. Sarah calls the eyes and ears that link their communities to the health center, are foundational pillars of the community medicine program. Their training gives them not only insight into people's problems, but enhances their credibility and their status, gratifications which lead them to bring a long-term commitment to their volunteering. Each time a volunteer's efforts lead to improvement in the life of a community member, her own power and authority are enhanced, and she becomes more of a go-to person for individual and family needs.
One of the volunteers found one girl like this, blind from birth almost, living with her brother and family. They would look after her, in the sense they would feed her, but really otherwise she was just tolerated. She had a friend in the neighborhood who would come and visit her. But what the volunteer did for her was to get her an identity card as a person with disability. This enabled her to then apply for a social security benefit. And as soon as she started getting 200 rupees a month, her status in the family completely changed. Because she was no more a liability. She was somebody who was bringing in money to the home. And that made a big difference. And what was really nice was the first money that this lady got, she gave away to the local mosque to feed those who did not have food.
Was she a Muslim herself?
She's a Muslim herself. So I have found actually amazing generosity among very poor people.
Dr. Sarah proudly delights in telling individual stories about volunteers and clients, and remarkable though they are, I wonder what is at the heart of this enlightened approach to primary health care. I asked Dr. Sarah how she and her colleagues came to expand and transform the work from practitioners of a traditional urban hospital to this much broader community practice with volunteers at its core.
Over many years, we have been discussing this whole idea of doing community-based rehabilitation. And a lot of discussion on whether is it going out to the community and then finding all the disabled people and doing something for them, or what really is the meaning of rehabilitation. And we finally, in our discussions, came to feel that what you need to do is to empower people to be able to maximize whatever potentials they have.
This is not usually what hospitals think about, though.
No. So I guess we are an unusual group of people. We felt strongly about this, and it didn't happen in a day. These discussions went for many years, I would say, before we actually launched into this program, and it all came together. So to maximize potential, we felt then the approach we needed to use was one of education and empowerment, which meant the volunteers were going to be people who were there with knowledge and skill. And if there were people in the community with knowledge and skill and a good attitude, then perhaps things will happen in the community. And what we have found actually is that these volunteers were really wonderful people. And the knowledge and skill they gained, they have multiplied and used many times over. They've been very innovative in looking around in their own areas and finding resources which they could use.
So they're still doing it, in other words?
Yes, they're still doing it.
How long has it been since?
It is now 6 years, seven
really?
Years.
Really? Yeah. So they're really committed then?
Yes.
As Dr. Sarah explains the difference between family medicine and community medicine, what I'm hearing is living proof of the enormous difference a single individual volunteer can make in the lives of others. I see how this becomes amplified when several like-minded women connect to each other for shared purpose, when, as Dr. Sarah puts it, it creates a way of working that chimes with the forces of life that exist within the community. I remind myself that we're in India, talking about slums and very poor rural people, where funds are scarce and where poverty does not conflict with human goodness. What a far cry from our society's flawed concept of healthcare.
Community medicine involves a little more of organization of health within community, whereas family medicine is focused much more on the individual, but sees the individual very much in relation to where they come from. So their particular environment is very important to the treatment of disease, and the environment would include the family. But in our outreach work, we've gone beyond just the typical family medicine kind of approach. We've also tried to look at the problems that are there in slum communities, because wherever you go, you encounter this. We have seen, urban communities do not have strong ties within family and between neighbors as much as traditional rural communities. But we've also seen enormous amounts of generosity between people, people helping one another in the midst of violence and chaos and fighting and all that also exists in the urban slum areas.
Right.
But undergirding that, we have felt very strongly a force and a resilience among people who are actually facing very great odds against life itself. So I often, when I listen to the stories of, particularly the women in the outpatient, I think to myself, what has kept her like this for 40 years? If it was me, in 2 years, I'd have curled up and died. But something has kept this woman going. What is it that keeps her going? So we feel that really we are not the keepers of health or life. It has to be in the hands of people. But we can encourage we can lift up, we can support, if we are sensitive.
Sensitive meaning?
Meaning being aware that this very nebulous entity actually does exist, to feel it. So, for instance, I have young interns who spend a week with me. And the one thing I try to make them do is to go and visit any one of their patients whom they've seen in the outpatient. When they go to the home, they come back completely gobsmacked, because they have never imagined that human beings can live like this. And then they say, in the outpatient, I would have never known from the outpatient that this is the condition that this person lives in. But then we help them to see that given that bad and impoverished physical mm-hmm. location that people come from, what is it that keeps them? What is it that makes them get up and come? What is it that makes them bring their child to us when they could very well have said, this is too much, I cannot cope with it?
So do you think that actually recognizing it and acknowledging it, seeing it,
yes,
they know that you see it? It's there anyway.
Yes.
You see it. You
yes.
recognize it. Make it visible.
You make it visible. I think yes. I think I would say our experience has been that this thing has caught from these 8 or 9 volunteers. They've been able to get a whole lot of young people to come together to help in their, for instance, they run a camp once a year with all disabled people. And they've managed to get young people to come to volunteer to help them with whatever it is they do. Over the years, this volunteer batch of young people, and sometimes it's more than young people, has grown. The young youth movement also got a lot of strong support when we had one young boy with cancer, and his friends went to the volunteer and they said to him, Maka, he has got cancer. Why did he get cancer? And will we get cancer? Because whatever he did, that we also have done. And so she talked to them and she came to us saying, these young boys live very, very difficult lives. They only know about being macho and violent and drinking and smoking and sex. Surely they must be taught that there are other ways in which you can live life. So, and she said, I don't know what to do with them. Can you help me? So we said, shall we talk to them?
So, but the fact is that they came to her. So she's obviously a visible figure in the community as
the
volunteer.
These young people felt comfortable to go to this volunteer speaks volumes for her, a status in that area.
Okay, so then she came to you and what did you...
So we said, okay, we'll talk to them. And she had told us about 4 or 5 young men. And finally, she and her husband brought us about 30 young men. And they said, if you can talk to 3, then you can talk to 30. So that's what we did. What was interesting is...
It was on the hospital grounds?
Yes, they came into the hospital. Mm-hmm. What we found was that they were really not interested in cancer. What was worrying them was drink and sex and alcohol and smoking and masturbation. These were the problems that really were troubling them. And HIV/AIDS. They had about 3 or 4 sessions and then the majority of them said thank you, because I think they felt that somebody had really listened to them and answered them fairly and squarely, told them what they needed to know. But a few of them came back to us and they said, in our conversations with you, we have heard that we can live a different way. Can we talk about that a little more? Now, this was for us a big challenge because we were not really prepared for it. It came out of the blue. Mm. But we sat together and we said, what can we do to help these young boys? And we put together in quite a hurry a 6-course life skills course in which we tried to make them look at themselves. And then the volunteer came to us saying, why are you only doing this with the boys? How about the girls? And then at the end of the training, we said to both groups that you must do something for your community. They were focused on waste. So we taught them about different types of waste and what you can do to dispose different kinds of waste. And
like garbage.
Garbage and rubbish. Because the streets are full of all this rubbish. So we took some classes on all that, and then we taught them how to social map their streets to see where are the garbage points. And in the process of doing all this, they came and said to us, actually, you know, the government is supposed to do all this. So we said, well, then go and talk to your representatives from the government. So mm-hmm. they went with these beautiful maps they had to the councillor of the area, and he said, oh, wonderful, do this for the whole area. And I think they thought, my goodness, this is not our work, that's his work. So they went back to him and said, you come with us, and then you find people in each street, and we will help them to do it for their own streets. And there ended the matter, because he really wasn't that interested.
But the fact is that they became politicized.
I think a little bit, yes.
They understood that there's the government and here's a guy who's elected to represent them.
And also, I have found some of these things don't happen then, but 6 years later, something may come out of it.
But all of this grew out of the fact that this one lad
had cancer. Yes. And that there was a volunteer there whom they were comfortable to go to. And she was constantly supporting all this move and, you know, all this thing. The girls chose to have a half-a-day camp for the elderly of their area. And they were amazing because they planned everything themselves. So they had this wonderful time together. And at the end of the camp, they said to the old people, you know, thank you for coming. You were so gracious. We are all young girls. You came forward to our invitation. And we really had a good time and we want to thank you. And we also want your blessing. And all of them just fell on their faces in front of these old people. It was an absolutely touching moment for us because they literally were prostrate on the ground. That's how we would in this culture show our really deepest respect for somebody.
You literally prostrate yourself on
the ground. One of the old ladies went up and she said a prayer for these girls and she really gave them a big blessing. So we ended on a very happy note. And the volunteer tells me that there's a whole difference in the relationship between the elderly and these girls.
Dr. Sarah Bhattacharjee is talking about the community health clinic that she runs in Tamil Nadu, India. This is Hazel Khan on Tidings on WPKN Radio. There's always a story waiting to be told if you're fortunate enough to have a storyteller who can bring it to light. I'm beginning to understand what Dr. Sarah means by the holistic integration of the biological and clinical, socioeconomic and behavioral, emotional and spiritual aspects of life. Her stories reveal how personalized this approach is, in which, as she puts it, the individual is valued, the family history is known, the patient is involved in making decisions, and the relationship between that individual and the staff is one of trust and friendship. But wanting to know still more, I stumbled as I framed the final question, asking Dr. Sarah to reveal the true grit of this story.
And all this generosity and all this involvement, engagement. So what is all that?
I look at it like this, that people are in webs of relationship and that sometimes we don't know
where we
are and who's connected to us. And some little thing highlights.
And it suddenly all lights?
Yes, and suddenly it lights up.
Wow.
And people hold hands. And it may light up and it may fade away. Mm. And then you find another network. So somehow that seems to be the kind of thing that is happening. So there are people who all actually in themselves are saying, I'd like to do something to help somebody. Or I want to make life better for myself and others. But I don't know what to do. And then suddenly across their path comes this volunteer or comes somebody from the hospital.
Yeah.
And then they say, okay, we'll join into that. Or, you know, people see us wandering around and they see that something has happened with people with the disability. Mm. And then they approach us saying, we have this problem, can you help us? The headmaster of that school from that slum called us one day saying, I have lots of problem children. Can you come and help us? And so from that work, we started to do these life skills programs in the schools. Then the district education officer came for a an inspection when we were there. And he said, what are you doing in this school? So we explained to him, and he said, why are you doing it only in this school? Mm. You come to my other schools. So now we are in 13 schools in the town, run by the government. So,
But your volunteers and your workers and your Sakai, all these people, they also have learned new skills because of all this. I mean, that's also kind of, if you look at the web and the lighting up of things, I mean, it also must have, because you can't, You can't be prepared for all these eventualities.
No.
I mean, either you...
And some things we don't respond to because we cannot.
Hmm.
And certainly it is not one way. I think that, you know, I have and my team has gained as much as we have given.
Hmm.
Sometimes we think more
than you've gained.
Than we've given.
You expanded hugely what health and health is and what hospitals do.
I think that's true, yes. I think hospitals need to be seen as not worlds in themselves, but as part of the community's resource for the treatment of illness or for the promotion of health.
Because that's a luxury that I guess poor people don't really have.
That's correct. In our work we try, and I think this is something that all family physicians will do, is to try and empower people with enough knowledge and skill about what they are suffering from so that at least they can look after themselves or they feel that they're in control of what is happening to them rather than not knowing anything and being completely dependent on professionals who may or may not do what is actually best for them.
Yeah, and opening their eyes to the fact that they do have, that there are solutions to their problems.
Correct.
And that they have access
Correct.
To that they didn't know they had,
Correct.
Even if it's just through some volunteer
Yes.
who's in the community.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
As we ended our conversation, Dr. Sarah told me about her colleague, Dr. Binayak Sen, whose work with mine workers and tribal people in Chhattisgarh has led to his incarceration for the past 2 years.
I have a friend and colleague who was 2 years senior to me in college and who has spent his entire life working with deprived communities, setting up a health system for mine workers initially, and then working with people who have been displaced because of the building of dams. I think his encounters with these people and the way they live and the way they have been exploited sort of led him to feel that he has to stand and speak for the rights of people, not just for the health, but look at health as a human right and approach health from the human rights perspective. So all his push for human rights has been through discussion and through writing and to talking about it. But he was very openly critical of the government and some of the policies of government. And so they have labeled him Naxalite and put him in jail.
By taking our lead from Dr. Sen and Dr. Sarah and framing healthcare as a human rights issue, we can open a radically new window onto discussions about healthcare reform. Been listening to Dr. Sarah Bhattacharjee on Tidings on WPKN Radio. Tidings is usually heard on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. Tidings programs are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.